Walk the streets are screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, today let's talk about some interesting reports that have been issued in the past week and recently that throw some light on some important developments in the economy. Well, let's start with today's jobs report. Then I want to talk about the Federal Reserve, our central bank's minutes and report of a few days ago, and then a report on Apple's $100 billion stock buyback and mergers and acquisitions and what all that means, and a Deutsche Bank report on U.S. debt warnings. And then finally, Europe, Eurostat, slowing economy again in Europe. Okay, let's begin. The jobs report. Okay, so unemployment fell even further again today in the latest jobs report for April. The U3 unemployment rate, that's full-time permanent employed workers, which is a declining share of the total labor force as we hire more and more part-time, temp, gig, and so forth employers. But the permanent, the U3, which isn't a very good indicator anymore, but nonetheless, declined to 3.9%. Well, it declined not because we increased jobs, which we did, but that wasn't the main reason. It declined because people left the labor force again. You see, we got this screwy way of estimating unemployment rates, and it's based upon the number of people in the labor force, as well as the number of people without jobs, so that if people leave the labor force, the percentage of jobs goes up and unemployment rate goes down. All right, so it's not because of some big increase in jobs. It's because people left the labor force, which is a negative sign of weakness. You know, if people enter who didn't have jobs, enter into the labor force, it means that they think there are jobs there. The market is good. But when they leave, it means they can't find jobs. I think what's happened is with all the hype and everything about the Trump economy in the past 6 to 9 months, people thought there were jobs and they started looking for jobs and they couldn't find the jobs. And now they're leaving again. Anyway, labor force participation rate is a very important indicator of the labor market, far more important than even the U3 unemployment rate. And then, of course, we have what's called the U6 unemployment rate, which captures people who haven't looked for a job within the last 4 weeks or even the last 52 weeks. And they may be underemployed part-time for economic reasons and would take a full-time job. Well, those figures are what we call the U6 unemployment rate, and that's still hovering around 8-9%. And that even that is an underestimate, I believe, because it doesn't pick up itinerant workers, undocumented workers, and inner-city youth, and people who've gone on Social Security disability because they can't find work, etc. You have to add probably at least 2% more. So the unemployment rate, the real unemployment rate in this country is really still about 10%. And this is supposed to be a boom time when the economy is doing so good, growing at 3%, 3 to 4% rate. Well, you know, economic theory said when you're growing that much, you should be hiring all these people. Well, the growth rate does not really reflect very well anymore on the employment rate, and that's because so many of the jobs we're hiring are part-time temp jobs, gig jobs. And that's the reason why, I believe, wages aren't rising. You know, it's another anomaly here. You know, all these job creation going on and the economy doing so good, but wages aren't rising. Why? They can't figure out. They're scratching their head and saying, well, why aren't wages rising? Well, they say, well, now they're beginning to rise, 2.6% growth, average 2.5, 2.6% growth here in wages. But wait a minute, that's average wages, including salaries of very high paid managers and professional workers in tech and so forth, right? That average gets pulled up by the pay gains of those people at the top 10% of the wage structure. Averages don't mean a damn thing because they're skewed by wage growth at the top. That's more than 2.5%. Managers, supervisors, tech people, so forth, they're rewarding themselves nicely. But the people at the median, no, it's not 2.6%. It's a lot less. And then you go below the median level for the average household, and it's even less. And then it's also overinflated by underestimating inflation. You see, the more you underestimate inflation, the higher the real wage. If we really reflected the cost of inflation for a median family, not for the whole economy, but a median family, it would be much higher. Well, look, rents are going through the roof, right? Cost of education is going through the roof. Gas prices are going up now significantly. Insurance premiums are doubling. Well, okay, if you really looked at that for the median family, it would be a lot more than the 2% inflation that's being reported now, and that would reduce the 2.5% for a median working family wage increase even more. Wages are barely growing for the median level, somewhere between 0 and 1%, and for those below it, not growing at all. Okay, that's the job report, and it's really a reflection of the composition of the job creation, which is very low in terms of real full-time employment. It's very high in terms of part-time temp, gig employment. And all those folks earn like 70% on average wage compared with full-time employed. So you hire more of those people, the average is going to go down. But then that average is offset by growth at the very top end, tech and managers and so forth. So what you get is this 2.5% or wage average wage increase, which is misleading for the vast amount of people, wage earners who are really at the median and just above and below. All right, so much for that report. The truth is always in the details. And the details on the wage, no wage gains are as I described them. So ignore anything that says average wages or average earnings. They're all distorted by being skewed to the top end. And always remember, for those at the median, the inflation effect is underestimated significantly. And then there are whole categories of people who aren't even included in the unemployment rates. All right, so much for the jobs report. And let's move on to the Fed. The Federal Reserve had a meeting here this past week, and the Fed decided not to raise interest rates again. Right? They already raised them once, but they're planning to raise them almost for sure in June. These are short-term interest rates that the Fed has some influence over, called the federal funds rate, and it will rise again, and it will push up all the other rates as a result. Now, this rate increase has an effect on the value of the dollar. Finally, now we're beginning to see the dollar rise in value as a result of the rate hikes, the rate interest rate hikes driven by the Federal Reserve benchmark rate. Okay, it pushes it up, all the other rates rise, and the value of the dollar then rises. Well, why does the dollar rise because interest rates go up, because investors offshore start buying dollars. They want to invest in treasury bonds and bills and so forth. They have to take their currencies and buy dollars to do that. Well, that increases the demand for the dollars, and that rises the dollars, the value of the dollar, its exchange rate in relationship to other currencies. So now we're beginning to see the dollar rise because interest rates are rising. That's beginning to put the fear of God into some of the emerging markets and investors, because when the dollar rises, what happens is people with investments in emerging markets in Argentina and so forth, Brazil, etc., start selling their currencies and converting them to dollars, driving up the value of the dollar even more. Why did they do that? Because they're going to lose money if they keep it in their current currencies, which will decline in value in relationship to the dollar. So they start converting, especially U.S. multinational corporations offshore. If the dollar rises, they want to get out of their local currencies and into dollars, because the currency will be a loss of profits of their operations offshore, whereas if they put it in dollars, they'll get an appreciation of their profits. So they convert too, you see. It's not just foreign investors, it's U.S. multinationals. To protect their offshore profit, they start converting. And that means a flight of capital, money capital, out of emerging markets. Ah, if you have money leaving, that means the value of the currency is declining. So what do emerging market country policymakers do? They start raising their interest rates in order to slow down the whole process of capital flight. That's happening in Argentina. That's happening in Brazil. It's been going on in Brazil for a couple of years now. Brazil has the worst recession it's ever had. Argentina's going into recession. All Latin America is going to fall into recession because of this phenomenon of emerging markets, capital flight, which they didn't respond to by raising their interest rates, which slows down their own domestic economy, you see, but it protects their investors to some extent by protecting the value of their currency and the value of their investments. But it's a losing game. They can't beat the Fed if the Fed just continues this. So Fed rate increases are going to cause havoc in emerging markets, and already are now beginning to do so. The Fed will continue to raise rates. Well, wait a minute. The Fed has always said that its target is 2% inflation in the U.S. Well, we're at 2% inflation, 2.2% inflation in the U.S. The Fed, quote, has attained its target. Why then will it continue to raise interest rates? If its target is 2%, raising rates until they get it to 2%, they should stop. But they're not. In fact, they're accelerating. We'll see at least two more rate hikes, and they're saying three more in 2019. Well, why are they doing that? Because Fed policy is never about 2% inflation target. That's what they sell to the public, right? That's their justification, their cover for doing what they do, which is to subsidize. To subsidize the banks, which they did for 7 years with near zero interest rates, free money for the banks, 7 years of it. Even though the economy was not recovering, they were saying, oh, we need low interest rates to get the economy recovering. And they just kept subsidizing, but we need to low interest rates to bail out the banks. Well, they were bailed out by 2010, but we kept the zero interest rates going for the banks, subsidize them. Well, in 2017, the whole capitalist strategy shifted from that monetary policy to fiscal policy. Instead of the Federal Reserve Central Bank subsidizing corporate America, now the tax policy, Trump taxes in Congress, would pick up the subsidization function by a massive $5 trillion in tax cuts, which they've passed. Okay. So now that 5 trillion in tax cuts is producing a $1 trillion plus budget deficit every year. $1 trillion plus. Even JP Morgan Chase Bank estimated the deficit this year at 1.2 trillion. Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office, almost $1 trillion. It'll be over $1 trillion. More importantly, it will be over $1 trillion every year for the next 10 years, and worse if we have a recession, which we will. We're going to add $12.4 trillion to the existing $21 trillion in U.S. federal government debt. 12 trillion more to it, and possibly even more than 12 trillion. Well, how is the U.S. going to finance that deficit? Guess what? The Federal Reserve is going to sell more bonds, more treasury bonds and bills. How are they going to sell more? By raising the interest that they'll pay the borrowers, i.e., interest rates are rising to finance the massive annual decade-long deficits that are now coming because of the tax cuts and because of increased defense spending as well, rising, $85 to $100 billion a year in the next 2 years, and they'll continue that as well. After we spent $7 trillion on wars in the Middle East with no results, $7 trillion, now we're going to up $100 billion more a year, the Pentagon budget. Okay, well, that's because they're turning to China, and there's a big war, technology war with China coming, and the wars of the future are all technology and massive investments going on there. Okay, so defense spending continuing to rise and massive tax cuts are producing these $1 trillion annual deficits, adding to the debt $1 trillion a year, which has to be financed some way. That means you have to sell more bonds, treasury bonds, which means the Fed has to raise interest rates to attract investors to buy those bonds. That's what's going on, and that's why rates are rising. Okay. Not only are rates rising, but as rates rise, it will slow down the U.S. economy. It's already having an impact, significant impact on the economy already in construction and in auto sales. To buy an auto, you're up all 4 or 5% now, and it's choking off sales in a big way. Autos are in big trouble here, and they're heading down. And of course, housing, except very, very costly housing. They're not building much because people aren't buying new houses the way they used to, at least the middle class. Okay, so two important sectors of the economy are taking a whack here and will continue to take a whack because of the rising interest rates, right? So in a way, we're saying that we're subsidizing corporate profits with massive tax cuts at the expense of the growth of the economy. And that's all embedded in what we've recently seen here with the Fed rate hikes that are going to continue. For a long time, I've been arguing that if you look at the 21st century U.S. economy, this massive subsidization is going on, both fiscal policy, then monetary policy, alternating back and forth. And more and more is being provided to investors and corporations, and the money is not going into real growth. It's not going into real investment in the US. It's being diverted. And I've been arguing, and in my recent books here, Central Bank is the End of the Rope, Systemic Fragility, Epic Recession. I've been pointing out that all this massive subsidization is being diverted from real investment, and you can see it in declining productivity as a result. But also, it's going into the stock market and the bond market. The very low interest rates made it very attractive for business to borrow, even though they were fat with profits. They would borrow the money and increase their debt load as a result, and distribute it to their shareholders in dividend payouts and stock buybacks. $1 trillion a year for 7 years in combined stock buybacks and dividend payouts in the U.S. The shareholders have been nicely rewarded with a massive amount of capital gains. And we've been, of course, cutting capital gains taxes so they can keep most of it. Okay, that's one place it goes, stock buybacks, dividend payouts. Another place it goes is directly into financial asset markets, both in the U.S. and abroad. Some of it goes is reinvested by multinational corporations from the U.S. Abroad, not just in financial asset markets, but real asset investment abroad, not in the U.S. And then finally, merger and acquisition activity. A lot of the money is going into M&As. None of this really generates economic growth in the U.S. It generates financial asset market bubbles in stocks and so forth. It generates acquisitions of companies, which usually result in a loss of jobs as the merged company rationalizes its workforce and lays people off. And it goes into foreign direct investment offshore. Or it's just hoarded on balance sheets. That too happens. Okay, I've been saying that, that was the picture up to and through 2008 into 2017. Now we have this massive tax cut, and we're seeing the same thing happening. You know, I've estimated this tax cut at $5 trillion for investors and businesses. As I've said before, $5 trillion total dollars, $2 trillion just for multinational U.S. companies offshore, because now they bring their money back at a 5 or 10% tax rate, and they don't have to pay anything offshore going forward in future years. All right, that's a big part of that $5 trillion. And then, of course, they raise taxes by eliminating deductions and exemptions for the middle class. And that's going to hit big time next year, you see. They scheduled this hit to us after the midterm elections this year. You know, when you go and pay your taxes next January, whoa, you're going to see. You're going to see how you're going to get whacked. But it's too late. They already got it installed, embedded, and got their people through the November election. All these politicians, especially Republicans, and some Democrats too. Okay, so, $3 trillion net Trump tax increase, tax cuts for investors and businesses, corporate and non-corporate, $3 trillion. $2 trillion. A hike, tax hike on the middle class. So the net is $3 trillion. And of course, they're saying, oh no, it's only 1.5 or 1.3 trillion because they make ridiculous assumptions about economic growth generating more tax revenues. You know, that's a supply side nonsense, supply side economic theory, which never worked, still doesn't work, won't work. You take away those phony assumptions about economic growth of 4%, 3 to 4% for the next 10 years every year, which is nonsense, will not happen, won't even come close. Well, then you've got a net of $3 trillion deficit. Okay, so where is this money going of the $5 trillion, you know? It'll be $1 trillion tax cuts this year, at least, of that total share, because the tax cuts for businesses and investors is front-loaded, you see? For the tax hikes on the rest of us, right, is going to be backloaded. You're going to start to see the problem in next year, but by 2025, now you're really going to see the tax hikes on the middle class. That's when it really begins to bite. Okay, so where is it going? Well, we're already beginning to see it, to see where it's going. Corporate profits, Earnings per share, recent data showed in 2016, U.S. corporate, if I'm talking about the Fortune 500 here, or S&P 500, negative. They were earnings per share profits were negative in 2016. They rose when Trump came into office to 13% for the year. And now they're on track for over 25% per year, the highest in the last 7 years. And for some industries and corporations, more than 30%, tech, oil and energy, banks, they're going to realize profit boost this year of over 30%, virtually all due to the tax cuts. In other words, they're not earning these profits anymore. The state, the government is subsidizing them, taking money from the rest of us for them. Over 30% corporate profit gains, right? Now, where are those corporate profit gains going? Well, Apple just announced a stock buyback program of $100 billion. $100 billion. They were keeping $252 billion offshore, so they didn't have to pay taxes keeping it offshore. And now this so-called repatriation tax measure allows them to bring it back onshore and pay minimal taxes in the first year and none thereafter. So they're going to start bringing back some of this money taxed at very low rates or no rates. And what are they doing with it? That's the next important question. What's Apple doing with it? They're buying back their stock, $100 billion worth. Apple's been doing this for quite some time. That's why Apple stock is so high. Apple's buying back $30 to $50 billion a year since 2013. And that's driving up their stock price. And because other investors see the stock price going up and their commitment to buybacks, they go in and buy Apple stock, raises the demand for Apple stock, which raises the stock price even more. It's buybacks and subsidization driving it that's keeping the stock market way up there in part, the buybacks. Where else is this going? Well, buybacks in the first quarter in general, here's a figure, up 50% over the fourth quarter of last year and up 66% over the first quarter of 2017. So buybacks have been running about $600 billion a year in dividend payouts, about $400 billion in previous years. Now they're going even higher. So what does that mean? Are we going to have $800, $900 billion in stock buybacks this year, plus another $400, $500 billion in dividend payouts? We're closer to $1.5 trillion distribution of profits to shareholders. $1 to $1.5 trillion this year, even faster than it was in the previous 6 years. Now, buybacks and dividend payouts aren't the only place that this massive tax cut is going. You can see it also in merger and acquisition activity. So far in 2018, M&A activity is running at $1.7 trillion, nearly double the pace of last year and the year before, 2016. Nearly double. 1.7 trillion. So, we got at least $700 billion going into mergers and acquisitions, and we've got at least that much going into buybacks, and another $400 billion going into dividend payouts. This is where all this money's going. It's not going into expanding production in the U.S. and therefore jobs in the U.S. It's going into financial markets and M&A activity. It's also going into investors investing in offshore financial markets. All right, another piece of data here. just came out. U.S. investors' holdings in Japan and European stocks in early 2017 amounted to about $350 billion. In the first quarter of this year, $1.2 trillion. You see, we have a global finance capital elite now that just moves their money around globally, and they're being nicely rewarded by the politicians. They're running the economic policy of the U.S., you know, Goldman Sachsers and all the key investment bankers and all the key positions in Trump, Trump administration, right? And they control the key committees in Congress. And the politicians are bought, and they're rewarding these folks nicely, to the tune of trillions. And that's what's driving the stock market, you see. That's what's keeping it up. All this M&A activity and stock buyback activity keeps it churning, you know. And even despite that, it's weakening. At some point, even that subsidized flow of buybacks and M&A is not going to be sufficient, and there will be a correction. But it's been hanging up there longer and higher than it ever should because of this artificial boosting going on of buybacks, dividend payouts, investors then plowing their money back into stocks, corporations doing the same, corporations merging and buying each other up, right? You know, profits, Apple profits, this year, up 25%, pre-tax profits, up 25%. Okay, well, iPhones they're selling more iPhones, right? They're not selling. Weak sales of iPhones. So the profits aren't being generated from sales. They're being generated from the tax subsidy. And that's true for all the major corporations out there. Especially, you know, in drugs and pharmaceuticals and oil and energy, banks, tech, and so forth. They're the ones who are reaping what's called rentier profits. You know, they're not earning these profits. They're getting it through manipulations of the tax system and the credit system and so forth. That's called rentier profits, you know. U.S. capitalism is turning more and more to rentier profits instead of generating real growth and real productivity and so forth. Well, that's exactly what happened to Britain as it was eclipsed as the dominant capitalist country. And now the U.S., after several decades of real expansion, is now weakening in terms of real expansion. And now they're turning towards ensuring profit growth through indirect rentier means, through the tax system, through the federal bank's central bank system, etc. That's a sign. That's a sign that it's growing long in the tooth. The U.S. capitalism is growing long in the tooth. It's by not on the verge of collapse by any means, okay? But it's aging. It's aging as the leader in the global capitalist economy. Okay, you know, back to this point about I missed a point I wanted to make also about the Fed buying. So far, the Fed in raising rates is engaging in a massive sale of bonds to raise money for the deficit, as I said. And so far, they have sold or projected to sell through September. $870 billion of bonds. That's not counting the fourth quarter or any other increases that might occur from now to September. So the Fed is going to sell over $1 trillion to cover the deficit over $1 trillion, you see? And as I said before, that raises interest rates, slows down the rest of the economy. But so what? The corporations, instead of having a robust economy making profits, they get their profits the easy way through the tax cuts. Right. Okay. Well, that's what I have to say about The evidence of these tax cuts and where they're going: buybacks, dividend payouts, M&A activity, investing in offshore financial markets. Now, when the Fed, has to finance these deficits, trillion-dollar plus deficits every year, it's adding debt. It's adding debt to its own balance sheet. And of course, Congress, when it creates these deficits through these tax cuts, is also adding to the federal government debt. There was recently a report issued this past week by Deutsche Bank Research, and it said pretty much that the probability of a U.S. Debt crisis is growing rapidly. It's still not at the tipping point, but it's accelerating. In fact, it's doubled in the past year, the probability of a debt crisis. Well, what's a debt crisis? That's when the level of the debt is so high that whoever took on the debt is having trouble or can't pay the principal and the interest. Maybe they can cover the interest, but they can't pay the principal, or both, which is far more serious, right? When you don't pay principal or interest, you default on your debt. And that means the collectors can come in and break you up. Well, they're not going to break up the U.S. government. But nonetheless, the U.S. government is in trouble as its debt, total debt, will rise from 21 trillion to 33 plus trillion over the next decade. By the way, the rate increase is not only because of the higher volume of bonds that have to be sold to cover the deficit, but the rising rate at which those bonds are being sold both add and accelerate the debt, you see. And this has become, this is even more sensitive because right now, 43% of all the debt is bought by government, federal government debt is bought by foreigners. Excuse me. And it's beginning to look like foreigners are slowing down their purchase of the debt, U.S. government bonds. In 2008, foreigners purchased 55% of treasuries, of all the treasuries sold. In 2015, that has slowed to 50%. Last year, it was 43%. And so far this year, with the Fed's accelerating auctions of selling treasury bonds, foreigners have only bought 16%. Whoa, wait a minute. If the foreigners who buy half of the debt stop buying half of the debt, what is that going to mean for the Fed being able to sell treasury bonds to cover the deficit and the debt? Well, what it means is the Fed will have to raise interest rates even faster, even higher. In other words, not just to finance the trillion-dollar annual deficit, but to finance it more from purchasers of foreign governments and foreign banks and investors and so forth, to entice them to buy it now that they're slowing down their purchases. We could see even faster Fed rate increases. And as I argued in my Systemic Fragility book, the rate hikes by the Fed will not have to go, will not go as high as they did in 2007-8, that precipitated the crash in 2008. They rose to 5.25% Fed funds rate. Fed funds rate still less than 2%. We're already seeing strains about foreigners not buying, waiting for the to go higher, and we're already seeing strains in emerging markets. So, what that means is that they're going to have to raise it even higher and faster, perhaps, to cover to entice these foreigners who are slowing down in their purchases. And that leads us to another complication. You see, all this global economic stuff is connected, right? Another complication is the current trade dispute with China. The U.S. is trying to put pressure on China. What is its objective? Well, the objective, as I said, is threefold: what the U.S. wants from China in these negotiations, and the team is over there right now, U.S. trade team, negotiating with China. What they want is several objectives reflecting different interest groups in the United States. Steve Mnuchin is on the team, Treasury Secretary. He's representing the banks. What the U.S. banks want: more access into the Chinese economy and the ability to fund and finance acquisitions of Chinese companies by U.S. companies of 51% ownership and 100% ownership, right? That's what they want, right? The bankers want more access into China. And that's one of the interest groups represented on the U.S. trade negotiations team, represented by Mnuchin. Another group on the team is represented by the defense establishment and the Pentagon. Peter Navarro, right out of the Pentagon, right? And even Robert Lighthizer, a hardliner, they represent that particular sector of the U.S. capitalist class in these negotiations. What do they want? What do they want? They want a slowdown and a choke off, if they can get it, of Chinese technology transfer. Right? China now has rules and regulations. If you want to do business, you've got to share your technology, U.S. corporation, if you're going to do business in China. And they are on a systematic plan, China is, planned objective of getting the best technology from U.S. corporations. What technology are they really interested in? They're really interested in artificial intelligence. They want to be a global leader in AI. They want to be a global leader in 5G wireless, and they want to be a global leader in cybersecurity software. Well, these happen to be the key technologies for war making in the future. And that's why the Pentagon and the defense establishment is worried about it. And they want to stop the transfer of corporations in China, transferring technology. And they're engaged in blocking China acquisitions and participation partnerships and U.S. companies. China's trying to buy up U.S. companies that are key to technology transfer. And the U.S. is now blocking them. Left and right at every move, right? They're really worried about this systematic attempt by China to become the leader in the next generation technologies, because those technologies have such implications for defense and war making capability. If you look at the tech patents being filed, it's just China and the U.S. The rest of the world's way behind. There's a race. Competition going on for who's going to capture the next technologies, the US or China. And that's what this is about, in part, technology transfer. I think that's the most important objective that the US wants in these negotiations, but it's going to be the hardest one to get from China. They can block Chinese acquisitions of US companies, but it's going to be harder for them to stop tech transfer for US companies already in China. The third thing that this trade team really wants, U.S. trade team, represented by Larry Kudlow on the team, you see all these four, these are the four key guys: Mnuchin, Navarro, Lighthizer, and Kudlow. They're the ones negotiating. Well, what Kudlow wants is to show something that Trump can then tout that shows he's doing something about the job loss to China trade. He either wants some token reductions, quotas, reduction, or quotas placed on some Chinese imports to the U.S., right? He wants some quotas on that, that he'll go to his base, his domestic U.S. political base, and say, "See what I did? I'm stopping incoming China imports here, which is going to save your jobs," right? Either that, or he wants more access for U.S. corporations to do business in China. either goods producing companies like U.S. auto companies or bankers. You see, the U.S. runs a surplus with services with China, but it's not as big as the U.S. deficit with China with regard to goods, right? We got a huge goods deficit with China, but we have a slight to moderate services surplus with China. And then the net result is still, well over $350 billion total deficit with China. So what Trump wants is to be able to get some sort of token concession from China on quotas or access that he'll then go back to his domestic base, in the Midwest and the farm. Farm country area, and say, well, look what I did. I saved you so many U.S. jobs. He'll lie, he'll exaggerate, he'll blow it out of proportion. He'll say this will happen and it won't. But that's what he wants for two reasons domestically, you see. The one reason is we got elections coming up in November, and if the Republicans get swamped and lose their majorities, possibly in the House, probably not in the Senate, right? If that happens, well, then his attempt to produce the legislation he wants, particularly on immigration and so forth, is gone. He won't be able to achieve anything after the November elections. So he desperately wants to be able to hold on to majorities in Congress so he can push through the rest of his agenda. I believe he also wants to show his base, his right-wing base in the Midwest, in these red states, that he's doing something about economic nationalism. You see, he's resurrected this economic nationalist theme here, which he won on in 2016 in swing states in the Great Lakes, where they were devastated by free trade and so forth, and offshoring and deindustrialization and everything ever since Reagan and Clinton and Obama and all of them, right? That's how he won. He won those swing states with that economic nationalism theme. America first, he calls it, right? Well, he's been going around and giving campaign speeches once again to that base. I think he's mobilizing that base, not only for the elections coming up, but just in case he has to go back to it and light a fire under them when he gets rid of Mueller. Mueller is this investigator that's coming after him, and the noose is tightening on him by the traditional elites in the East. And he knows it's coming. He knows the firestorm's coming. And I think this America first, this nationalism, is part of his agitating and mobilizing that base to defend himself somehow. So domestic politics, domestic U.S. politics, and Trump have a lot to do with the trade policy and the trade offensive. I think Trump whipped this all up at the beginning of the year because. In part, at least, he had plans. He had plans to do this, and the tax cuts were now out of the way. Now he could focus on trade and economic nationalism, and that's what he's doing. And we'll see how that plays out in these negotiations with China. It's not a trade war yet with China. Yes, they've identified $50 billion in tariffs. We've identified $50 billion in tariffs on them, and Trump has said that maybe $100 billion more. And they say, "You do that, we do that," and nothing's actually happened yet, though. You see, it's all talk and it's all on paper. Nothing on either side has been implemented, and we'll see what negotiations happen here in Beijing. I think that Mnuchin and at least Mnuchin and Kudlow want some kind of a token agreement that they can then hype back in the U.S. I think the Pentagon folks, that interest group, is kind of worried and will continue to be worried about technology transfer. I think the Chinese will make concessions on quotas to the U.S. and access. They're already doing that, signaling that. They've already said U.S. can buy companies can buy 51% ownership in companies in China, and in 3 years they can buy 100%. Well, that's a big plum for U.S. multinational corporations. And Mnuchin likes that because that's who he represents, you see. And Kudlow, if he can get some token quotas, he can go back and Trump can go to his base and tout that. But China's going to play tough on technology transfer, right? That's the one, and it would be interesting to see if Trump is willing to sacrifice that in order to get something to promote for the election purposes and something that will satisfy the big corporations who will make contributions, campaign contributions. So that's the essence of what's going on with these trade negotiations, I believe. I recently wrote a piece called Trump's Phony Trade War, and you can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com. In that, I say there's a dual-track policy, trade policy going on. One track is this key negotiations with China may become a trade war, is not a trade war yet. I think 60-40, it won't be. But the rest of Trump trade offensive with all the U.S. allies is a phony trade war. It's a token war. It's exempt, you know, he starts out with steel, aluminum tariffs, right? Then he exempts them all. And he starts out with, in the NAFTA negotiations, you know, half of all the auto content from Mexico and Canada has to be U.S. made. And then he drops that. Says, oh, things are going fine with NAFTA. I think NAFTA is going to look a lot like South Korea, where South Korea, the third largest steel importer to the U.S., is in the agreement, essentially was given a free pass. They can import now as much steel as they want to the U.S. That whole agreement was just a token softball agreement, a little bit on quotas here and there. But nothing in terms of tariffs, nothing on steel and aluminum. So the whole steel aluminum thing was a lost leader, you might say, or a tactic to get attention in the press that he was doing something on steel and aluminum. Oh, then he can go to Pittsburgh and give a nice speech, which he did, right? Make the people think that he's doing something there. Nothing much is going to change with steel and aluminum tariffs. Not with NAFTA, not with Brazil, the fourth largest. Germany, I think, is a third or fifth largest importer. Nothing's going to happen there eventually. It's going to be softball. The South Korea trade deal with the U.S. is the template for negotiations on trade with U.S. allies, other than China, you see. It's a total different picture, trade with China. But anyway, read my article, jackrasmus.com, about the softball side of the dual track trade offensive of Trump, and then subsequently a second in the series where it will simply focus on the U.S.-China trade, you know, the maybe possible trade war. That's the second edition, and then the third edition in that series of articles I'm writing, they'll all be on my blog, jackrasmus.com. The third is really trying to put this so-called Trump trade offensive in some historical perspective, comparing it to Reagan's offensive against Japan in the 1980s and Nixon's offensive against Europe when he blew up the Bretton Woods system to get a better advantage for U.S. multinational corporations back in 1971-73, right? The U.S. periodically engages in these trade offensives, especially after it passes tax cuts, you see. Then it turns to trade to get another bite of the apple in relationship not only to U.S. Working class folks, but that's the tax cut side, but to get an advantage with regard to its capitalist competitors around the world, right? The tax cuts... you know, the average effective tax cuts have been reduced to the low 20s in the U.S., and that compares to their competitors in Europe and so forth of in the low 30s. So the tax cuts gave the U.S. companies a competitive advantage in terms of tax costs. The trade thing is designed to give him a little bit more advantage. So we're going to see what happens with NAFTA next, and after that, emerging markets, and after that, Europe. I don't think they're going to be very tough on Europe either. It's a softball for the rest of the world, and it's possibly a hard ball here, maybe a curveball for China. So we'll see what happens with those trade negotiations. But in the meantime, another report is that Europe is now slowing down again. Once again, for a third, fourth time, Europe just can't get going economically. The recoveries are short and shallow, and it slips back repeatedly. And that's what I call an epic recession, by the way, in my book, defined that. Short, shallow recoveries from a crisis, followed by short and shallow declines. Epic recession. Europe is locked into an epic recession. Okay, so those are the reports. Those are the main reports here. The U.S. warning by Deutsche Bank, its debt is now becoming a problem. And then the reports on buybacks and stock buybacks and mergers and acquisitions and foreign investment following the tax cuts. The Fed report on raising interest rates here and funding the deficits. And then the job report, which shows us once again wages really aren't rising when you look at indicators other than averages. Okay, that's it for today's Alternative Visions show. Next week, I'm sure we'll have more to say about the negotiations in China. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.
Streets are screaming now.